Hello, everyone, and welcome back once again to another episode of the Trino Community Broadcast. My name is Cole Bowden. I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Manfred Moser. Manfred, we've got another exciting episode today.
Yeah, it's awesome. Like, we left the Easter Bunny behind, and we're talking Commander Banban and Trino again today. That's awesome. Love it.
Yeah, and it's we keep rolling. We've got interesting talks. So today, we're featuring Isfahan from Mitsu, and we'll be learning more about what's going on there. We'll explain what that is when the time comes. But before we do that, of course, we have to give you updates on what's been going on in the Trino community, what's been happening in Trino at large, what's been in the releases, and we'll go over that real quick. So, Trino 442, we added support for configuring your deployment type for the OpenSearch connector. OpenSearch, kind of a new connector in Trino as a fork of Elasticsearch, so still some things to iron out there, and that helps you make sure that you can manage your deployment type without any issues. Also, very important, if you use Iceberg, there was a big regression in the 440 release of Trino. You will want to upgrade to 442 as quickly as possible. If you're on 440 or 441, I should say, get to 442 as quickly as possible. Skip those versions if you use Iceberg. For all other connectors, if you don't use Iceberg, 440 and 441 are totally fine. But that's just an important thing for the community to know. If you are encountering some errors that you shouldn't, that is why. 443, we have all files being deleted when S3 file system support is enabled. That way there's no dangling ghost files or anything like that, which is a bad thing to have, bloats your storage. And also added support for custom authorization header name in the Prometheus connector. So more support for making sure things work in our probably lesser used connectors. So
there's right? Like last time we talked with Matt and David about Prometheus uses indirectly, right? So it's always good to have all these tools in your belt, right?
Yeah, and there are people using it, so it's good to continue improving on those things when we get a chance. Exactly. 444 included a pretty big fun update that we're both excited about, Manfred.
Yes.
Java 22 has some pretty key features for development that'll empower the engineers working on Trino to move even quicker and make it even better. And it also signifies that Trino is officially on the cutting edge of Java releases. We had previously gone from long-term support to long-term support Java releases. Now we're on a short-term support Java release. So we'll be bumping from Java to Java as they come out and are supported by Oracle. So that's pretty cool.
Just to note, we didn't on purpose go from long-term to long-term. We just weren't active and agile enough to jump more often. Now we are. And so it's really good. And also note that Java 22 is not required for the runtime just yet, but it will be very shortly. This is our first test balloon where the Docker image now ships with Java 22 in it. And we want you all to test this and see how it goes. You shouldn't really notice anything apart from maybe some important performance improvements, but who knows, right? Like all the testing we've done and the production usage that we know from other people doing it already look good. But we very much would like your feedback as well if you run into any issues.
Thank you for that. That's a good expansion on that I was not of. In any case, a couple more things. We have a bunch of performance improvements for the Snowflake connector. The Snowflake connector, of course, relatively new in Trino. It's a pretty exciting and big deal that you can now query your Snowflake data with Trino. And it's being patched up and fixed. So expect that to become a little more mature as another couple releases go by and the Trino community continues to hammer down on what's making it tick and what makes it work. Support for reading byte stream split in Parquet files, that affects a lot of different connectors, and support for canned access control lists with the native S3 file system. So less micromanagement on that front.
Also, I want to point out, like, Marios and team around the Delta Lake connector, they've been ripping. Like, look at all these changes as well on the Delta Lake connector and additional features on the Delta Lake connector. So heads off, well done. There's lots going on. And as you can also see, the Iceberg connector is also coming along. And here's our Snowflake connector improvement. So really love how everyone is stepping up and pushing in and making all these connectors good. And even new connectors like the Snowflake connectors are pretty darn powerful already, right? It has write support and all sorts of stuff. So pretty cool.
Then we got other Trino news, Manfred.
Yes. super nice. We got Trino Gateway 7 out, and that has the new user interface, which our Starburst Trino champion Peng has contributed. Like, he came out of nowhere. Well, at least it looked like out of nowhere from us. He's, in fact, a long-term Trino user, and he's over in Shanghai, works in a financial company, and has been using Trino Gateway and noticed, like all of us, that the UI is ugly. But he took it one step further and he improved it a lot. So Starburst awarded him as a Starburst Trino champion and sent him a bunch of, like, you know, backpacks and cool Trino plushies and other things like that. So thank you so much. And also, when you look here, you see there's another Starburst Trino champion, and that is Tamash Sevanak, who is a long-term Apache Maven committer and contributor and all-around maestro and master around Maven. And Apache Maven is obviously the build system for Trino, and he has been helping us improve some, like, dust out some old plugins that we had still in there that were problems, and, like, get us up to the latest Apache Maven release, and actually, in fact, also get us ready to move towards Maven 4, which is the upcoming next release. So we're kind of a bit of a hot test bed for Apache Maven in that sense, because, well, Trino is a big project. It's a complex build. There's lots going on, like, you know, UI plugins and Docker plugins and crazy test suites and all sorts of stuff. So Tamash helped us a lot with that. So he's our Starburst Trino champion number 2 this episode. So thank you so much to both of you. We love your participation. We also love how you keep participating. So Peng already sent another pull request, fixing up little things here and there and stuff like that. So and these improvements from Trino Gateway also kind of flow back to Trino, because sometimes there's issues that we find in Trino Gateway where routing is, like, wrong when you talk to multiple clusters and stuff like that. And then so there's a good collaboration between the projects already going on as well. So it's very exciting to see all this cool action happening.
Yeah, and once again, congratulations to both of them, and thank you to both of them. It's really cool when members of the community that we haven't seen contributing before show up with massive, influential, impactful contributions that make the project much better for everyone else. It's one of the key perks of open source that we really like to see. And so we like giving out acknowledgement when we get a chance. But that brings us, Manfred, to what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this episode.
Yeah, me too.
I cut you off with the sound thing there.
Hi.
We have our guest on board. Thank you so much for joining us today, István, who is the founder and creator of Mitsu. Maybe introduce yourself and let us know what Mitsu is a bit more of.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation, and I'm happy to be here. As you said, I'm István. I'm the CEO of Mitsu. And essentially, this is my last year and a half, actually, being a CEO. But before, I was a data engineer and lead of data engineering teams in various companies, namely maybe one probably you know as well, Skyscanner. I was working there as a data engineering lead for one of the teams. And time went by, I joined other like product development companies, startups as data engineer. And essentially, I've seen a problem in these companies that led me to start my own project, Mitsu.
So did you know Trino beforehand already in those companies as a data engineer, and were you a user of Trino back then?
We tried Trino in multiple places. We didn't use them in production. We were experimenting with it, but ultimately we chose different solution. But I played around with it a lot, yes.
Okay, cool. Now, First question about Mitsu. That's a cat, right?
Yes. Yes, everybody asks this question. Why is it like a Hello Kitty branding? You know, if you look at our competitors, everybody is like very enterprisey, very like serious.
Yeah.
We want it to be something else. We want it to be friendly, simple, nice, you know, cute as a cat. We've been like an open source project for a while. Now we are not. But when it was open source, this cat was really, it was for the collaborators or the contributors to the project. We kept it because essentially we just love it.
that's great. I mean, this is going to work out really well today because Cole loves cats. He has two at home, and we will prove that cats and bunnies can get along today.
You know, it's, I think it works better in tech than it does in the real world, but
I haven't tried, to be honest.
Yes.
So tell us about what, like when I read the, like, sort of like, not the announcement, but like the shortcut about what Mitsu is, it's a warehouse native product analytics platform.
Yes.
So explain a bit what, like, what is product analytics?
Yes.
Why would you bother, and what is different when it's like warehouse native? So there must be some magic there. Tell us more.
Yes. So let's start with product analytics. I think the easiest way to explain it, it's for each person is different, but usually I start with, if you know companies or like products like Amplitude or Mixpanel, that's product analytics. Basically, product analytics is a subset of data analytics in general, but it really focuses on product usage behavioral patterns. So,
oh, that's where you come to the understanding users, huh?
Yes, exactly. So essentially, what you do with product analytics, you try to find patterns in product usage, so your company or your business can make better decisions, which features to invest into, or which features you can like kill off and leave it.
Because it's not used or whatever, right?
Exactly. Let's say if you have a mobile app and one of the features is not used, basically you can just remove it and save resources for other features. And product analytics is a kind of data analytics that can help you understand the usage patterns in any product or service. Yeah.
Okay, so you said mobile app and you said product and service. So what products can you use? Like, I mean, if it's a mobile app, can it also be a web app? Can it be a website? Can it, like, what else?
Any digital product that you can find online, or like it's on your phone or something like that, website, web application, sometimes even IoT, I would say, like some type of embedded type of application, something like that. But it's mostly mobile and web apps.
Okay. And so what do you need on your end to analyze what the product is doing? Like you must be getting some data, like what data you're looking at.
Yeah, exactly. So in any type of product analytics you use, or like the traditional ones like Amplitude, Mixpanel, or like warehouse native ones like Mitsu, you need event data from the product itself. And event data is generated by the users of the product. So essentially, you can imagine like you have your mobile app, somebody taps a button on the mobile app, and that button tap itself generates an event that is sent up to the server and is stored in a data lake or data warehouse. And that event is essentially the data that is used in product analytics. You can imagine like multiple millions of users generating the same type of events, and with product analytics, you can see them in aggregation.
But it could be any event, like, I don't know, like you said, IoT. So like, could it be like, I don't know, like car, whenever I switch on the blinkers and lights and whatever, or like, I don't know, or something. I'm just coming up with something here.
Very good question. It could be event, any type of event, but it has to be tied to a user, because it's user behavior analytics. New trends also show like not just users, but like an account level, company level analytics as well, but still product usage behavior patterns are really tied to users. Mm-hmm. And not really sessions. For example, that's typically something that also comes up. In like historically, people are looking at sessions in websites, let's say like that. But it's more the trend is going about the users. Are our users retaining? Are our users, I don't know, using certain feature? How many of them are using this certain feature?
I know what you. So like when you say session, let me understand. So that's more about like random users coming and going, using the site. But like, if that same person comes back, you wouldn't necessarily know. But for product analytics, you want to know it's the same person. Is that what's happening?
Exactly. Okay. You know, there is a concept of stickiness in products, or like, you know, you start to like some product and you want to come back and use it. And you want to see this if the same person comes back and uses the same features again, over and over. And with session analytics in the history in the past, it was kind of, we lost a lot of information in this, because the same user could have done multiple sessions, maybe 1,000 sessions, you know, but it was still only one person that loved your product. And you had like kind of skewed understanding about your product, that how lovely it is, or how they like it, because you had like 1,000 sessions, but only one user actually that uses it. So now the trend, actually since the last actually, it's not that new. It's like the last 10 years, 15 years. We really look at users, not sessions.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
fair. So Mitsu enters the equation. And the problem we're trying to solve is that I, an app developer, have logged a ton of data, and I have all my event data sitting in a database somewhere.
Yes.
And now I want to analyze it. And that requires SQL wizardry, right? You need a really good data scientist.
Yes. Yeah, or, so, yeah.
I can use Mitsu, right?
Yes, exactly, as you described. By the way, we have multiple personas, and each persona uses it in a different way. A data analyst or like a product developer uses it differently. The primary persona we are targeting is a product manager, who is non-technical, we call it. So basically, a person who doesn't speak SQL language. And this person has maybe hundreds of questions about the product usage behavioral patterns during a day, a single day, hundreds of questions. And that person would need to delegate all these questions to a data analyst or data scientist who can translate to SQL. So a product analytics tool, in contrast to, let's say, a BI tool like Tableau or Metabase, it is really designed for product managers that are non-technical. So they themselves can ask the questions over the data that is stored.
So, cool. I look forward to seeing that because, like, I think product managers and products in general are often very visual. So I'm guessing there's some sort of like visualizations in play as well. Because if you just see a wall of numbers, it doesn't necessarily mean anything, right?
Yeah.
And the other question I have is, in order to enable this, do you need to log your data in a certain shape or structure? Or can you simply allow me to be aware of what event data looks like and then it adapts to that?
Yes. So with our current customers, we have identified three data models that they use for storing events. I'm not going to go into details how they differ. I have a blog post about it. It's a it's a long discussion. Probably there are more data models that we don't yet maybe support, but the three major ones we see over and over coming back. By the way, number one is if you log an event from your mobile app or web app, it lands in a single table in a schema. Only that event is stored in that table. And each column in the table is called event property. That kind of describes the event of what happened in the mobile app.
Okay, that sounds familiar to me. So
it's like a log file with lines.
Yeah, I'm believing it's exactly. Most common because that's
very important. I will cover the other main one, which is appearing as well. It's called one big table. So all your events, regardless like what's named, like button clicked or page view or something like that, it lands in a single one big table. We see that often as well.
And then you have your column for event type where it's like a string name of exactly what the event
exactly,
was. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
And event properties could be like different columns. But imagine if you have like 1,000 different events that have 1,000 different event properties, you will end up with 1,000 different columns in the table. So that is kind of like not very advantageous.
Yeah.
That's how we get these Trino users that come with like, oh, I have this table that has 4,000 columns and this and that doesn't work. I'm like, well, why did you do that?
And this is the second and the third one I'm going to cover as well. It is very similar to this one big table, except the properties are not in columns, but let's say they are in a hash map or map type or like in a JSON type. So it's a dynamically changing column type. That is actually, so we see in certain type of companies that going for this direction and startups, smaller companies going for like the one event per table type of model. Yeah.
I would think that scales the best, to be honest, because like if you have a JSON file in a column, then each time you want to do analytics, you have to parse all these JSON blobs. It's like, oh, God.
Yes. Yeah, there is limitations to that. But for example, we support JSON as well if it's flat. Only about, like one layer, and the map types, they must be flat, like more or less. With scalar types or strings, map types we support as well. So we support all three of these types. I've heard some other types as well, which may come up in the future as a new model. But I'm not going to cover that now.
No, that's very cool.
Yeah. So we plug Mitsu into our data with any of these different models.
Yes.
And then what's it do? I'm a product manager. I don't want to write a SQL query. I just want answers.
Yes, yes. If you want, I can show it. Do a quick demo, and basically I just show the visuals what it creates.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah. Should we pull your screen up here?
Yeah, please. Before we jump into two, I'll just turn back to the event data models, and I'm just showing this like what is it going to show, like what event I'm using in the demo. Essentially, I have this like e-commerce schema. This is Starburst. I have e-commerce schema in a catalog, and I have these tables here. And as you can see, they may correspond to a single event. Let's say like checkout events. This has an event name column, but it actually only contains the checkout event type. I have the event time when this checkout happened, and I have the user ID who did this checkout event. Right? And the rest of it is like properties, country code, language, number of items in the basket. Imagine this is like an e-commerce app or something like this, Amazon or something like that. The size of the basket in terms of like dollars. Basically, this is the checkout event table. But let me show you page events. This is slightly different because it contains two event types here. So this is the like the one big table model I mentioned before. But again, there is event time, user ID, a couple of properties. So this is how typically a product company will end up storing their events in a data lake or data warehouse. So
can I ask, interject for a second? So yes. This is Starburst Galaxy, and that's your warehouse native part of the like what Meetsu is. Is that what it means? Like you're basically plugging in Starburst Galaxy with some underlying storage. I don't know. This is probably some object storage somewhere. Some like, I don't know. Is it S3 or like with Iceberg or what is it?
Yeah, this is S3 with Parquet files. This is not much data, so it's a single Parquet file. You know, each table is a single folder in S3. Very, very basic stuff.
The warehouse native part is that Meetsu will work with this data, and in this case, Starburst Galaxy and Trino provided, basically.
Yes. So for that, to answer that, I will switch to Meetsu. So this is Meetsu itself. Let me close this here. So it's a bit less overwhelming. This is already a product analytics user interface. This, if you know Amplitude or Mixpanel, those are very similar to this. So here, a product manager would come in and look for the events that happened in the mobile app or like this e-commerce website I showed you the data for. Let's say checkout. So the product manager picks the event, and the application immediately shows a type of aggregation that is relevant for the product manager. So now what you see is the unique users or visitors that did this checkout event in your product. But this is the warehouse part, but for your question, all of this data is coming from by executing this SQL query, which is auto-generated in Meetsu on the Starburst Galaxy cluster.
And obviously that's important because a real product manager probably wants to see sales in the hundreds of thousands or more, not in the dozens. Otherwise, they won't have a job. So that there will be lots and lots of data. And that's where the warehouse part comes in, I guess. Is that sort of like why?
If it's not a warehouse native product analytics application, you would need to copy all your data that is here to an external service, let's say Amplitude or Mixpanel, just to do these clicky, you know, UI interactions.
Well, and that gets expensive. If you have to move the data around, that's like not fun, isn't it?
Exactly. So that's our main value proposition, that if you are going with the traditional or third-party product analytics, we call them, you need to copy all your data. First of all, it's very messy because your data may change. You know, like some data modeling process or like some in the orchestration part of your data platform, something changes and your data tables or event tables change, you would need to resend all your data to this third-party application, essentially copy. But imagine terabytes of data, you know, or petabytes of data. So just copy over it over the internet that amount of data takes a long time. It's costly. And it's very, very, very hard to do for data engineers.
So we're saving project managers the issue of having to write SQL queries, and we're saving data engineers the problem of having to pipeline this data into somewhere else where you might use like this more user-friendly analytics tool. So it's you're cutting off two different parts of this process by just putting it to it. And so this is resting on top of Trino. Is that how it's working? Is we're translating our UI into SQL, and then the SQL is executing via the underlying engine?
Yes, exactly. So essentially, if I would look at like my query history here, I will see this query I showed you here that was executed.
So it's just running queries underneath the hood without you even noticing. That's very cool.
Exactly. You don't even know what happens under the hood as a product manager. But if you're a data person that takes care of your cluster, then you will see the queries executed by Mitsu on it. And we also put like some information on top of it as a comment in the SQL queries that where is this query coming from? You know, my user ID, my email even is here. Who was how I was signed in to the application. And I can see the workspace name where I'm. So this is the workspace Trino commit broadcast. And every detail about this query that was executed is shown to the responsible person for the cluster.
So in the beginning, I guess you somehow have to set this up, right? Like somebody has to go and hook up like Mitsu to the data sources, but then it's ready to roll basically.
Exactly. So integration, what we see, can take from like 5 minutes or let's say 10 minutes up to a couple of days, depends on the data warehouse or data lake. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's very short time. When it's slower, what we ask the company to change some parts of the data lake or data warehouse. And not because we cannot process the data, but because it may be slow.
Oh, like you were saying before, that JSON, big massive JSON blobs that have to be parsed all the time. That's like going to be a pain, right?
Exactly. So that we've seen like some very old, like you know, legacy data lake houses or data lakes with Parquet files only that are wrongly partitioned, you know? So then we suggest the company to go back and change a little bit or use some type of like Iceberg or Delta tables that can be like indexed or kind of like or Z ordered, let's say in case of Delta, that you get better performance out of it. Mm-hmm. So we can always connect into the data set. They can always set it up. It's just the user experience for the product managers that can be not the best. So in that case, we go back and suggest some changes to the company.
Yeah, and obviously you want it to be fast on all the data because the product manager will want to understand relatively quickly where to invest, right? So if it's painful, they won't do it. And then that defeats the whole purpose, I guess.
Exactly. So the number one metric what we look at for our customers is the response time of the clusters, how fast the queries are appearing in the application. I have to say, like, we are very good. Even with funnels and retention, that can be very complex SQL queries. I'm going to show you a couple. Let me just pick, let's say.
Maybe tell us what, like, there's this, like, I can see the segmentation, funnel, and retention. What does that mean?
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to segmentation. Essentially, a segmentation type of insight answers very basic stuff, but important for the product managers. So here what you see again, the number of checkouting users over time in your application. But let's say you want to compare the number of checkouting users based on some property that you have seen in the events. Let's say, as you remember, I had in my data here for the checkout events, I had country code. So the product manager in this case wants to see, it's kind of ugly chart, let me nicen this up. The product manager wants to see the checkouts segmented by the country, which country produces the most users that does checkout. And that's how they basically break it down by the checkouts. Under the hood, it's basically a single group by based on one of the properties from the table.
But you would never be able to do it. Like you just clicked a few buttons and then you had these nice charts that like it immediately give you some sort of like insight on what's going on, which countries are active. You would never be able to do that quickly with even a BI tool, you would have to understand the data model, but here you don't have to really. That's cool.
Exactly. That's the value of me. So like, you don't think about tables and like columns, but you think about events and properties of events. And there are typical reoccurring questions for the event type or product analytics. The most often used are segmentation and funnels. And let me just show you like a funnel type of query. So what I want to see in the funnel is that I want to segment, let's say, page visits based on, let's say, acquisition campaign. That can be a marketing type of event property, which can answer like, how did we acquire the person who came into the application? And if we acquired the person, did that person do checkout within a single day? So I know it's a lot to take in, but this is basically how they use funnels. A marketing person or like a product manager even will look at this chart and say like, okay, I can see that Facebook Amer, the acquisition campaign, had the highest conversion rate. So that campaign is performing very well. So again, it answered a key business question immediately for, let's say, a marketing person or a product person.
You can do that with like new sign-ons to the application as well as constant usage after and features and everything.
Exactly. Yeah, you can pick any event what you have. We have here subscribe, that is a different event. It'll be a different chart definitely. It's a In this data set, subscribe means something else as sign up, but you can imagine you could have like a sign up event. You can have some financial events. Let's say invoice is paid. That could be an event in your data warehouse. And you could bring it here and use it in a funnel.
I guess that explains the retention. Like, they keep using it and they keep subscribing and keep paying me. Exactly what you want, right?
Exactly. Yeah, subscribing you do it once, but let's say if you
but then you need to renew, right? Like, kind of stuff, right?
Exactly. If you came into the website from a campaign, are you coming back week over week? And do you do checkout in this application? And which campaign was leading to the best retention, let's say checkout retention in this case? I usually tell it like this. It's a checkout retention because the retaining step is checkout. And I want to see which campaign was doing the best retention for our application. And just to show you like the warehouse dating part of it, this is the size of the query that we are generating.
Yeah, that's not
here's a right tricky question that I suspect the answer will be no to, but I just like to ask it. Is does it do automatic join ordering based on sizing, or does it just let the engine handle that?
In terms of retention, we do joins, and we don't really do optimization on the SQL part for it. There was no need to do that, but good question, actually.
The good news is Trino does order its joins under the hood for you if you have it configured the right way. So
yeah.
I just like to ask.
It's a very good question. We have seen some companies having like billions of users, active users in a year, let's say. And if you use joins on events, let's say that you have a billion users from the whole globe that generate hundreds of billions of events, and if you would use join between the two event tables, essentially the cluster would be like flooded with data because of the Cartesian or dot product nature of joins. And how I understood it, I'm not a super expert in Trino memory management, but what we've seen that if it exceeds the cluster memory, the data that is resulting the joining, it will store it on a disk temporarily. Correct me if I'm wrong in this.
The FTE mode can do things like that. There's also like joins that can be broken up and broadcast joins. Anyway.
Yeah. But the main point, it will be very slow.
Yeah.
So essentially what we came up with, that funnel queries, and that's the retention as well, it's just not really yet, can be done with window functions instead of joins.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a better application and a very cool usage of Trino.
Yeah, exactly. Especially this one, lead, we use this lead window function with ignore nulls. So by the way, that's why we in our team, that's why we really like Trino, because it has a lot of features seen in SQL that other data lakes don't have or data warehouses. Just like this, lead with ignore nulls. The ignore nulls part is a lot of time missing from a data warehouse solution. And because of this this feature, we can do joins with funnels with window functions. So we skip the join part that is very memory heavy. And instead, we do a union all on two event tables. I have a whole blog post about this. It's essential. This will speed up the funnel queries, sometimes even like 15 folds. So your queries will be 15 times faster. We have measured that for a couple of customers that have a huge number of visitors and huge number of events.
Wow, that's crazy. Well, I mean,
that's always shout a good out day too when you get to brag about the 1500% performance improvement.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Kasia and Martin for working a lot on that window function stuff. That's been pretty cool work.
So, exactly. Again, some data lakes, data warehouses still miss this feature, the ignore nulls. And they have window functions. That's pretty common. But ignore nulls is missing. And that's a key part in this. Yeah, essentially, the whole query becomes, if you think about it in, let's say, Java or like Python or imperative language, this will make it a for loop, the whole event, this funnel event matching, while a very simple for loop. While a join would be a very, very complex for loop that will end up in, like, how you call it, parabolic space complexity. I may be wrong here, but it will consume much more space. But I can show you the other part as well. This is how you can turn it on in the application to use the join type of funnel. It will be a simpler SQL. We will use joins, but essentially the query itself will require much more memory. But the result is the same. That's what I wanted to show you. The result is the same.
Interesting.
So this is a web application that you run for your customers, I guess, somewhere in the cloud, and then they log in and configure it to run against their data.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a cloud-based SaaS application.
And it doesn't matter where their data is, like you connected to Starburst Galaxy, which is also obviously in the cloud. But like, can it be connected to a Trino cluster elsewhere, or like, what can you do?
Yeah, exactly. You can connect it to any Trino cluster or Starburst cluster. The main point is that it has to be publicly accessible, and the SQL engine. You know, we should be able to run the SQL queries. You know, these queries should be executable in the cluster. So that's the only requirement. You know, sometimes it's like behind the firewall in the company, or like some VPN they are using. In companies, in that case, we ask them to open up a port for our server IPs. Mm-hmm. But essentially, that's the only thing that we have seen so far as a problem.
But like, Mitsu always runs in the cloud, basically.
Yes.
Like, and you manage it for everyone, so no one has to like look after it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the moment, we discourage companies to like start to run on-prem, but there are discussions inside in the team that we should maybe open it to the on, like, let's say on-prem or self-hosting it in certain ways. That's a business question that we have to answer. So far, like, companies, even very big companies, like this cloud nature of it, that they can just like plug and play.
Yeah, it's definitely less hassle, right? Like, that's why Starburst Galaxy is the same, right? Like,
It's
much easier to just like sign in and click a few buttons to fire up your cluster, and in this case here, do your analytics, then to have to worry about Helm charts and virtual machines and Docker containers and whatever else.
Exactly. I mean, cost wise, I think it seems to be like, if it would be open source, it would be like nice to have a self-hosted open source version of this. But maintaining it, I think it's very often more costly for a team or like an engineering team than just buying it off shelf from the provider. With that mind, I can just show you around like how to connect. It's very simple.
Yeah.
This is how I have it, like the host of our Galaxy cluster, authentication, everything. And what you have to do essentially is very simple. I just, in this event tables tab under this workspace settings, I just listed my tables that contain the events from this e-commerce schema. And I just configured the necessary columns, user ID, event time, and the event name column, although some of the tables don't have multiple event names, but I still have it here. Click the save and update event catalog, and essentially you're good to go.
So given that this is connected to Trino, does that mean it doesn't, like, it, like you're saying warehouse native, so I guess you said Parquet files in an Iceberg catalog, but like given that it's Trino, it could be whatever, right? Like it could be like an Oracle database as well.
Currently we support eight data lake, data warehouse types, you know.
Yeah, but what? Like I'm saying in Trino, right? Like in Trino, it could be a catalog that looks at a different thing.
Yes.
Then it would like for all intents and purposes, your system wouldn't really know, right?
Yes, exactly. If it's Trino on top of, let's say, Postgres or like Oracle, it doesn't matter. It's going to be still Trino SQL.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be translated to Oracle SQL or something like that. So for us, it's still Trino. So we really don't care.
Yeah, so that might be interesting for people that like throw their data, I don't know, into like, who knows, Elasticsearch or something.
Yeah. The only caveat to that is that we currently only support table listing from a single catalog.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
In case you have like some different needs, or the company has different needs, we always suggest to create like a bunch of views in your one of the catalogs that doing the unions or joins or different selects from the underlying data storage solutions.
Yeah, that's enough, right? You can just create views or even materialized views. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, or like we've seen sometimes like they directly, from a view that is in one catalog, they directly do selects in another.
From somewhere else, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But this is just like a simplification for us so that you don't have to fill, let me get back here. So you don't have to fill the catalog information here as well, because it's 99% of the time is the same catalog. And actually 98% of the time, it's the same schema as well. We just still give the option to pick a different schema for events.
Yeah, I guess also it gets more complicated for the users and potentially has performance implications, and like then it gets a bit headachy. And you want to keep it simple, right? So that that makes sense.
Yes, exactly.
So, can you tell us some like practical experiences or like what customers practically use it at? Like people that you're working with, like.
Yeah, and why would they use this over something similar?
Yeah. So to be honest, like there is two types of product analytics application. I already mentioned like Mixpanel and Amplitude that require you to send your data. You know, what we see, why companies switch to us from those like Amplitude, Mixpanel, is because of the cost. The number one reason is cost. If you compare ourselves to them, we have seat-based pricing model. So essentially you buy 10 seats and you pay for 10 seats forever. You don't care about how much data you have, how many users you have. While Amplitude, Mixpanel, and these other type of data product analytics solutions, they price on based on the volume of data you have, or like the number of users you have a monthly. Because they have to run their infrastructure, they have to store your data, you know, they have to charge on the volume of data. There is other warehouse native solutions as well in the market. What we are different compared to them is that we try to be PLG. This is how I tell it usually. So we want companies to come in and try them, to set up for themselves. No sales process, no sales calls, everything. Just sign into Imitsu. You can come into our website. You can start for free login. And you can set up your own warehouse connections and try to use it or start using it immediately.
That's great and easy, because you can just like create an account here, create a Starbucks Galaxy account, throw it at like configure to throw a look at your S3 and Bob's your uncle.
Exactly. So most of our competitors, they are like sales heavy. You know, it's a different market. They are going for a different market. That's how I would describe it. By the way, I think all of I don't want to say anything bad about any of these competitors. They are very, very good products. That's how we differentiate ourselves. Like we go for the self-serve nature of this business. You know, it's very important for some companies to have like this self-serve. Some companies like the, you know, like the accountability part of it, like, you know, sales process and everything, and, you know, hard, long running decisions.
Yeah. But like, I mean, ultimately, it's not like you're like just not there at all. Like, if they are logging in and they have account and they start playing around with it and have a question, I'm sure they can contact you, right?
Yes. Definitely, we have like a Slack channel. It's here. You can join our Slack. We have LinkedIn. You can write an email. Anything. We essentially are. We have full-time support. Essentially, like anytime you can contact us. It's just the process how we acquire customers. That's different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have support. Like basically, so far I think we never had a support case that wasn't answered within a day.
Cool. So when like you showed us Mitsu and all these cool features, if I'm a product manager and I find some really cool insight and I want to expose that to to my leadership team, do I have to take screenshots and make a slide deck out of it, or what am I gonna do?
Great question, by the way. So let's just create an insight. So you can, if this loads up, you can share this link to the company in a Slack channel or like some other chat application, or send an email. If you refresh this link, actually it will show up the same. It will show the same result. So everybody will see the same result. That's one of the things. The other is you can name your charts or insights. Let's say like checkouts over time. I just named my insight. I can even describe it and click save. And this will essentially save it in the background. And you can create a dashboard. Let's say my dashboard. Great. And you can store your insights inside a dashboard. And let me pick the newly created dashboard. And you can collect insights into the dashboard, multiple of those. And you can share also the dashboard. So it's a typical like Metabase or like Tableau. You have these dashboards and you can collect information that are, you know, somehow tied together into this dashboard and keep it here. And just click refresh and everything in the dashboard will be refreshed for you.
Yeah, so you can set up things that you do regularly once and then that's it.
Exactly. So yeah, what happens usually most of the time is that a product manager puts together a dashboard for a new feature they just released, and they look at the most important KPIs about that feature, like how it is used, what's the engagement with it, how widely it is adapted, what's the retention for that feature. So they put together a couple of charts and they refresh it. And once the feature is kind of established in the product, they just delete the dashboard and they, you know, go on with the next feature with a new dashboard.
And then later they find out that that feature is not used anymore.
Yes. Yeah, they tend to keep it as well, yeah.
That's really cool. So those charts are like customizable as well. Like, I mean, like it's all blue, and I saw on your home screen, like on the website, it was a different color scheme and all that kind of stuff. So you have like lots more like visualization options. Like even with just a few clicks, you did a whole bunch there.
Yeah, exactly. You can pick a different like chart type, bar chart, this is bar chart. If you have like a breakdown, let's say country code, then you will have it in the bar chart. It will be a bit messy this way, but you can pick, let's say, a stack bar, and that is more readable. It really depends on the user, how the user wants to see it, or you can pick like a stack area. That's like an area chart. In terms of like retention, let me show you another type of chart we have. So this, what you will see soon, it's called we call it overall retention, but what you can have is a cohort retention. It's a very complex thing, cohort retention. Not that many people use it actually, it's hard to understand. But if you have seen a retention chart, or if you Google retention, it will show this type of chart. Hmm. Yeah. So basically this, what it means is like you want to see weekly cohorts of users, but which is on this like y-axis, and how did they retain week over week in your application doing checkouts, the checkout events.
Cool. So So this is like a more technical / theoretical question. So how does this all work? Like you have like what's this application written in? Like is it all like front end Java script, or is there some back end? And then how do the queries get fired into the warehouse? Like you have some sort of code that creates the queries, but then how does it get them into Trino and whatever?
Yes. So the front end is like a React application. The back end is Python. Uh-huh. Python is very good for this type of data applications because essentially just to support all these data lake, data lakes and data warehouse solutions, we could use SQL Alchemy actually to generate all the SQL queries. SQL Alchemy currently is not just for databases like PostgreSQL, MySQL, but every major data lake or data warehouse has an adapter for SQL Alchemy. And if they don't have, we can write it ourselves. But the main point is that we have a single abstraction layer in the backend code that generates all these queries. And SQL Alchemy translates it to the native SQL language of the data warehouse.
Okay, so that means it's the same as Apache Superset, for example, which is a BI application that uses
exactly
a Trino Python client and SQL Alchemy on top of that, and then in the application there. So it's the same sort of stack.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It works great for us. We can introduce, if you have a data lake or data warehouse that is not supported yet, we can introduce that in a single day.
Oh, if there is one of those drivers.
Yeah, if there is one like SQL Alchemy library for it. Yeah.
That's cool. So are you coding this or who is coding this?
Yeah, so we have a team of engineers. I'm sometimes coding. I have to tell. I like coding. I started it. I built like most of it. I really like to code still. But unfortunately, like being like CEO is it takes most of my time.
Right? Yeah, now you have to do podcasts. Oh,
yeah, community broadcasts, such a burden. We're taking you away from the code.
So that sorry.
Now I like it's when I go home after work and my kid is sleeping and everybody is like calm. I sit down and code sometimes, just to relax.
Well, if you have any for the Trino Python client, send them our way.
Yeah, actually, I have to tell that this is the only one we didn't have to like vendor and tweak some things in it. And we kind of copied a lot of code from the Trino SQL adapter, SQL Alchemy adapter, to other SQL Alchemy adapters. Because it already supports like hash maps and struct types and everything. So in case of Parquet or like Delta or like Iceberg, there are like struct types, and they already supported it. So we actually didn't have to touch it. That's a good part.
That's cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much for the walkthrough, Mitsu. It's a really fascinating product. I can see it being super helpful. It's pushing compute to your compute layer or your analytics layer and enabling low cost analytics for people who don't want to write 150 line SQL queries. There's a lot of people who don't want to do that. So I really see it finding a home. And at Trino, we're always excited. You're giving the power of Trino to people who otherwise historically wouldn't be able to run it. So it's a really exciting extension to what's capable with analytics. And I think it's a cool product. So thank you for showing it off to the Trino community. And hopefully our viewers on YouTube can find a way to put it to use for themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much as well for the opportunity to present it. Yeah. And happy to be part of this community as well. So.
All right. Well, Manfred, we'll say goodbye to you, Isfan, and we will pull up a couple more things that we need to go over to round out this episode.
Yeah, tell me, are you excited or are you excited about
Trino Fest? Oh, Manfred, it's Trino Fest. It's our first in-person event in a year and a half that is actually a big conference. We've got our speaker lineup just about finalized. Talks closed. Submission for talks closed today. We've already got
shout out to everyone. Like so many awesome submissions. We love it. We have the problem of having to select now, which is a difficult problem to solve.
Yeah, we have too many good talks all of a sudden. We're going to have to say no to people we don't want to say no to. But Trino Summit is in another 6 months. So those who we like may get to talk then instead. So Trino Fest coming up. If you're just attending, make sure you register. Book your hotel if you're going to come in person. We're in Boston in the summer. One of my favorite cities on earth in the summer. The reason Boston has problems is the winter exists. But when you're there in June, that's not a concern. It's just beautiful, perfect weather the whole time.
And also for a quick glimpse, we already have three talks on the agenda. Martin is going to do what's new in Trino, obviously. And then we'll have some use case with Apache Iceberg for data engineers from Cloudinary. And Brian Oates is going to talk about Iceberg Views. So Those are already sorted, but there's going to be lots more interesting ones.
Yep. Stay tuned for more soon. The call closes tomorrow. So make sure you register as well. It's virtual if you want it to be. You can register to attend online and watch the live stream. But we'd encourage going in person. It's worth it. And you get to meet people face to face and have conversations, which is super exciting.
Also, shout out for those of you coming in person to Boston. We, on the next day, we have a Trino Contributor Congregation planned, which is an in-person meetup that's a bit smaller for people that are actively contributing code and like really interested in diving deep in the code. We also have the regular Trino Contributor calls as virtual ones now, but this one is in person, and you need to please let me and Cole know that you intend to attend that, because we have limited seats, so we need to figure out who's coming and who we have room for, so to speak.
So a couple other things, Manfred, you should talk about what you're going on with Open Source Summit.
Yeah, I'm taking the boat to Seattle because I'm in Victoria, so it's not that far. In 2 weeks' time, the Open Source Summit North America is happening in Seattle. And I'm also going to go down there and chat to whoever wants to chat with me about Trino and anything else. I will be at the event all day. So please contact me. And then on the 18th in the evening, I will be presenting a Big Data Whirlwind Tour with obviously a view from the Trino's angle at the inaugural Data Engineer Things meeting in Seattle. So that's going to be really fun. There's a new user group that's been like, you know, making waves and having lots of it happening. And it would be good to be down there and also meet a couple of Starburst people from Seattle. So should be a fun trip, and I hope to meet many of you there.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Trino Contributor Call is happening monthly. So the contributor meetup at the fest is going to be the in-person one. But if you want to join the call monthly, that's virtual. Anyone can join. Once again, message us on Slack if you want to join that. And we've also got another Trino Community Broadcast episode planned already. I actually haven't had any involvement in that. Manfred, you probably weren't qualified to talk about that.
Yeah, it's going to be super exciting for all the Java developer geeks, because Lucas Ader is going to join us. He has Juke as a project that allows you to basically write Java code to talk to a database. It translates into SQL. And he's a Java champion and like very well-respected Java developer. And I'm sure it's going to get deep and dirty and technical. So that's going to be a really cool episode. So,
all right.
And if you want to present at another Trino Community Broadcast episode in the future, ping us and let us know.
Yep. I think that's it from the two of us. So to all of you watching mostly on YouTube after the fact, thank you for tuning in. We look forward to next time. And thank you again to Isfahan for showing us the wonderful world of Mitsu. But that's going to be it from us today. So have a good one.
Bye.
Music for the show is from the Mega Man 6 gameplay album by Krzysztof Swawikowski. Don't forget to give us a star on the Trino repository at github.com/TrinoDB/Trino. And for more information on future shows and to find show notes, check out trino.io/broadcast.